15. Is enlightenment enlightening? Over the ages, the equation of enlightenment and liberation has assumed many forms and found many audiences. The original headquarters of the CIA had Jesus' version of the equation etched in its wall, "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And the movie The Matrix, as we saw at the outset of this book, offers a truth-freedom linkage that echoes Buddhist philosophy. Life as ordinarily lived is a kind of illusion, and you can't be truly free until you pierce the illusion and look into the heart of things, until you see it for yourself. As Morpheus puts it to Neo, you will remain in bondage. But there are important differences between the Matrix scenario and the Buddhism scenario. For starters, the truth in the Matrix is easier to describe. Sure, Morpheus says you have to see it for yourself, but the fact is that he could have given Neo a pretty clear verbal picture of it. Robot overlords have put humans in gooey pods and are pumping dreams into their brains. There, how complicated was that? Certainly, it's an easier claim to grasp than, say, that the self doesn't exist or that everything is empty. There's another sense in which those robot overlords give Neo's predicament an appealing simplicity. Namely, they give him something to rebel against, and rebellions are energizing. An oppressive enemy focuses the mind and steals you for the struggle ahead, which would come in handy with meditation because it really can be a struggle. Getting on the cushion every day, even when you don't feel like it, and then trying to carry mindfulness into everyday life. Too bad that in Buddhism, there's no evil perpetrator of delusion to fight. In traditional Buddhism, actually there is. The Satan-like supernatural being named Mara, who unsuccessfully tempted the Buddha during the epic meditation session that led to his great awakening. Mara, though, has no place in the Western, more secular Buddhism that is the backdrop of this book. Kind of disappointing. But there's good news on this front. If you would like to think of meditation practice as being a rebellion against an oppressive overlord, we can arrange that. Just think of yourself as fighting your creator, natural selection. After all, natural selection, like the robot overlords, engineered the delusions that control us. It built them into our brains. If you're willing to personify natural selection, you can carry the comparison with robot overlords a bit further. Natural selection perpetrated the delusion in order to get us to adhere slavishly to its agenda. Its agenda being, of course, to get genes into the next generation. This is the core of natural selection's value system, the criterion that guided the engineering of our brains. And we have every right to decide, like Neo, that our values differ from those of the force that controls us, and that we want liberation from it, which means, first and foremost, liberating ourselves from the delusions through which that control is exercised. This declaration of independence is, of course, in no way undermined by the irony that, in a modern environment, these delusions often fail to serve natural selection's agenda of genetic proliferation anyway. There's a second virtue of thinking of the Buddhist path as a rebellion against natural selection. Looking at things that way helps us put a finer point on what we mean by liberation and by enlightenment. And it helps us answer the big question, is enlightenment really enlightening? I mean, obviously enlightenment is enlightening, that's why they call it enlightenment. But is the Buddhist version of enlightenment, the end state, enlightenment with a capital E, enlightening? Is it a radically truer view of things than our ordinary experience? Is it the ultimate truth? I've argued in this book that when you meditate, you may, in various senses, see things a bit more clearly than you saw them before, and that this clarity can grow, increment by increment. But what about the sum of all increments? What if you made it to the end of the path? Would enlightenment be a pure, unadulterated view of truth? This may seem like a moot point, since most of us have little realistic hope of attaining full enlightenment. Still, to say that you'll never reach something isn't the same as saying you're not approaching it. Even if enlightenment is an idealized, hypothetical state we'll never experience, even if it's an idealized hypothetical state that no one will experience and no one has ever experienced. It's what the meditative path is in theory headed toward. So if we want to know whether we're moving toward the truth, and whether we'll still be moving toward the truth no matter how far we go, it would help to know if this state is the truth itself. The Enlightenment Checklist. We should start with a basic question. What is enlightenment? How would the world look if you were enlightened in the Buddhist sense of the term? Well, broadly speaking, the answer is that you would see the truth of the central ideas of Buddhist philosophy. And when I say, see the truth, I mean see the truth. Actually apprehend the truth experientially. It's one thing to be led intellectually to the conclusion that, say, the self doesn't exist. As we've seen, there are psychologists and philosophers who have been led to suspect as much by some combination of data and logic and introspection. But most of them haven't had the kind of powerful experience of not-self that can impart deep conviction, a conviction that surpasses intellectual persuasion in its power to change lives. So too with the idea of emptiness or formlessness. There are philosophical arguments for this idea, and some people find them persuasive. But attaining enlightenment would involve being experientially, not just intellectually, convinced, seeing, so to speak, the emptiness. Okay, so not-self and emptiness. What other things would you have to see to qualify as enlightened? Well, there's no single official definition of enlightenment that has been endorsed by Buddhists of all stripes. There's no list of prerequisites for an enlightenment certificate that you can check off. But if there were such a thing, an enlightenment checklist, it wouldn't, by mainstream Buddhist reckoning, end with these two experiences, fundamental though they are. We've already seen a few additional bullet points on that list, some of which are more like insights, such as seeing the impermanence of everything, and some of which are more like feats, such as overcoming tanha or craving. It turns out that there are various other feats listed in one Buddhist text or another that are linked to enlightenment. There is the overcoming of specific fetters, such as lust and conceit and ill will, and there is compliance with the precepts laid out in the Eightfold Path, don't steal, harm other beings, indulge in malicious gossip, and so on. So enlightenment in the fullest, most traditionally Buddhist sense, isn't confined to the metaphysical dimension that has dominated this book, the idea that reality, both inside and outside of us, is very different than it seems. There are also explicitly moral dimensions. On the other hand, as we've seen, in Buddhist thought, the metaphysical and the moral are linked. Meditatively apprehending Buddhism's central metaphysical claims is said to erode the psychological roots of bad behavior. Indeed, letting go of things like lust and conceit and ill will is an intrinsic part of the metaphysical apprehension known as not-self. It's this metaphysical moral linkage, the fact that certain moral values are implied by metaphysical enlightenment, that makes the clearer perception of reality tantamount to a rebellion against natural selection. The particular values implied by this clarity, the values you would fully embody if you reached full enlightenment, are in many ways directly at odds with the values implied by our ordinary view of reality, the values that natural selection embedded in that view. Well, aren't we special? Consider for starters what some would call the core experience of enlightenment, the not-self experience. More specifically, consider the subset of it that I've called the exterior not-self experience. How does this experience imply a rejection of natural selection's values? As we've seen, the experience involves a diminished sense of separation between you, or you, and the other people and things in the world. In fact, there's such a sense of continuity between your inside and the world on the outside that you may start to see harming others as tantamount to harming yourself. In the fullest version of this experience, you start to doubt that there's any real difference between their interests and yours. Well, from natural selection's point of view, this is heresy. If there's one idea that natural selection has built into me, it's that I have distinctive interests and should focus on them. On those occasions when some of my interests overlap with the interests of others, then fine, we can do business. But if there's no such overlap, my interests take priority. This principle follows from the logic of natural selection. If inside me are genes that were selected because they've been good at getting copies of themselves into the next generation, then job one for these genes will be to take care of the vehicle that can carry them there, that is, my body. And that means these genes will build into my brain the idea that taking care of this body is much more important than taking care of other bodies, except perhaps when those other bodies belong to close kin. In other words, I'm special. My specialness lies very near the heart of natural selection's value system. This premise is built into all animal life, and you see it in all kinds of ways. Animals kill each other, for example. That includes human animals, though often humans assert their specialness more subtly, as when they peacefully undermine rivals. Indeed, the premise of our specialness informs our most pedestrian behavior. If you're trying to hail a cab, and you notice that someone next to you is also trying to hail a cab, you naturally reach your arm higher so that you'll get the cab and she won't, even though, for all you know, your rival is a physician who is on her way to save somebody's life. So this one element of enlightenment, the exterior version of the not-self experience, with its dissolution of the bounds between you and the world, hence a constant continuity of interest between you and all of life, involves abandoning one of the most basic precepts built into us by natural selection, that I am special by virtue of being me. Now that's rebellion. But is it truth? Are the values of natural selections that are being rejected in the course of enlightenment actually false? Yes, in some sense. Consider the absurdity of the current situation. This planet is full of people operating on the premise that their interests trump the interests of pretty much everyone else on the planet. Yet it can't be the case that everybody is more important than everybody else. So a core tenet of natural selection's value system is internally contradictory. Rejecting it, then, would pretty much have to move you closer to the truth. In the case of the exterior not-self experience, rebellion against the values of our overlord does seem to amount to some measure of enlightenment in the everyday sense of the word. It moves us toward a truer view of the world. And what about the flip side, the interior version of the not-self experience? This version, in which you cease to own your thoughts and feelings, also involves a rejection of natural selection's values. After all, the kinds of thoughts and feelings our brain is inclined to have were initially designed by natural selection to help take care of this vehicle containing our genes. So identifying with these thoughts and feelings, owning them, and thus letting them own us, is often just another way of asserting our specialness. When I'm trying to hail that cab and trying to keep the less worthy person next to me from hailing it, I'm owning my desire to get in a cab ASAP and get to the next stop on my uniquely important itinerary. If I let go of that feeling and cease to identify with it, in other words, take a step toward the interior version of the not-self experience, I'm rejecting natural selection's insistence that I consider myself special. Take that, natural selection. So too with the case of the snoring yogi in the previous chapter. As long as I identified with my dislike of him, I was obeying natural selection's instructions to consider myself special. Certainly more special than a guy who wants to catch up on his sleep when I'm trying to meditate. To the extent that I disowned those feelings, I experienced a bit of not-self and defied natural selection's values. I don't know exactly what it would be like to have the full-on not-self experience. But I've got a feeling that my sense of specialness, of unique privilege, would approach the vanishing point. And if that sense of specialness is indeed false, an illusion implanted in us by natural selection, then, exactly to the extent that it did approach the vanishing point, I would be approaching the truth. Emptiness as truth. Aside from not-self, the most famously counterintuitive metaphysical truth claimed by Buddhism is emptiness. Like not-self, emptiness is both a philosophical doctrine and a meditative experience. If you ask Buddhist philosophers to defend the idea of emptiness, they will talk about how everything is too interconnected for anything to have independent, self-sufficient existence. If you ask me to defend the idea of emptiness, I would take a different tack. I'd focus on the experience of emptiness, not the philosophical doctrine, and argue that this experience is in a sense more valid, more truthful, than our ordinary experience of the world. The argument for the truth of emptiness is basically the same as the argument I just made for the truth of not-self. The experience of emptiness, like the experience of not-self, defies and denies natural selection's nonsensical assertion that each of us is more important than the rest of us. But the logic of the argument is less obvious here than it was in the case of not-self. So let's take a closer look at it. Emptiness, you may recall, is, roughly speaking, the idea that things don't have essence. And the perception of essence seems to revolve, however subtly, around feelings. The essence of anything is shaped by the feeling it evokes. It is when things don't evoke much in the way of feelings, when our normal affective reaction to things is subdued, that we see these things as empty or formless. At least, that's my view, a view that draws support from psychology and from the testimony of some very adept meditators. So if you want to know whether emptiness is closer to the truth than our ordinary apprehensions of the world, you might want to ask about the feelings that give us those ordinary apprehensions, the feelings that create the sense of essence. Should the feelings that come naturally to us be trusted as guides to the truth? No one who has read or listened to this book up to this point will now be waiting in suspense for the answer to that question. We've touched on the question in various places, including earlier in this chapter, and consistently, the answer has been that our feelings are, in one sense or another, dubious guides to reality. So in a way, we've already established that if our intuition that things have essence is indeed informed by subtle feelings we have toward them, this fact alone should inspire doubts about that intuition. But there's a sense in which our feelings deserve even more mistrust than I've suggested so far. It's a pretty cosmic sense, and explaining it will require backing up and revisiting the question of what feelings are for in the first place. But if you can't get cosmic when you're pondering the meaning of enlightenment, when can you get cosmic? So let's back up and revisit. Feelings in cosmic context. At the dawn of organic sentience, when feelings made their first appearance in the living world, their mission was to take care of the organism, specifically to get it to approach things that are good for it, like food, and avoid things that are bad for it, like toxins. As beings got more complex, the behaviors that feelings induced got more complex than just approaching or avoiding. Like, for example, yelling at people who are doing things that are bad for you, and flattering people who might do things that are good for you. Another way to put this is that feelings, viewed in the context of their evolutionary purpose, are implicit judgments about things in the environment, about whether they are good for the organism or bad for the organism, and about what behaviors, approach, avoid, scream, flatter, will be useful for the organism given these judgments. This, as we saw in Chapter 3, suggests one sense in which feelings could be called true or false. Are those judgments accurate or inaccurate? Sometimes, especially in the modern world, they're inaccurate. Witness road rage, rampant anxiety, and various other kinds of feelings that don't serve the interests of the typical 21st century human being. But note that phrase, serve the interests. This whole evaluation, by accepting a particular organism's interests as the criterion for whether judgments are accurate, is accepting natural selection's basic frame of reference, that you, this particular organism, are special. Your interests are the most important interests, and therefore your particular perspective, the perspective that judges everything in relation to those interests, is the appropriate perspective for evaluating the goodness or badness of things in the world. Is that the way feelings and the perceptions they foster should be evaluated? From your particular perspective, or for that matter, from anyone's particular perspective? Before we go further, I want to assure you that I'm not going to suggest that you start ignoring all your self-serving feelings. It makes sense for each of us to spend a certain amount of time taking care of ourselves, and for that matter, our loved ones. I don't recommend that you quit doing all the things you've traditionally done on the unspoken premise that you and yours are special. You should keep eating, for example, and brushing your teeth. Imagine how awkward it would be for everyone to brush each other's teeth. And you should drive close kin who are sick to the hospital. Although these kin are, in fact, not more important than your neighbor's kin, there's a certain social efficiency that results from people caring for other people who, conveniently, live in their house. It's feelings that motivate you to do these kinds of things, and in these kinds of cases, I say it's fine to trust your feelings. This will, of course, include feelings that inform the sense of essence. Even though, strictly speaking, it's a self-serving feeling that makes your home seem to possess essence of home, I don't see any reason to fight that feeling. It is fine to be drawn into your home, and it will lead to fewer uncomfortable encounters than being drawn into randomly selected homes. And once you're in your home, by all means, feel essence of dog or cat or son or daughter or spouse or partner, unless, perhaps, domestic tensions have transformed one of these essences from warm and fuzzy to cold and harsh. Up to a point, seeing the world from your particular perspective has its virtues from a standpoint of social efficiency and even social harmony. And yes, simple pleasure. And is a pretty defensible way to approach the bulk of your daily business. But what about when you're not going about your daily business, but rather are asking basic metaphysical questions? What about when you're trying to figure out whether feelings, in informing our sense of essence, are fostering perceptions that are true in some objective sense? Should we ask those kinds of questions from your perspective, or from any particular person's perspective? Einstein and Enlightenment. Einstein became famous by asking a similar question in the realm of physics. He acknowledged that our intuitions about the physical world, about how fast objects move, for example, work fine for the purpose of steering each of us through that world. After all, for practical purposes, what matters is how fast things are moving in relation to us. But, he said, if you want a deeper understanding of physics, you need to detach yourself from your particular perspective, from any particular perspective, and ask, suppose I occupied no vantage point. Since I wouldn't be able to ask how fast things are moving relative to me, what exactly would it mean to ask how fast things are moving? Questions like this led him to the theory of relativity and the realization that E equals mc squared. Well, any path of inquiry that's good enough for Einstein is good enough for me. A type of question that leads humankind to understand the relationship between matter and energy as never before has a pretty good track record when it comes to enlightenment. So let's ask a question about essence that's analogous to the question Einstein asked. What happens to essence when we let go of our particular perspective? The perspective that the feelings that shape the perceived essences of things were designed to serve. I think the answer is that essence disappears. After all, without a perspective to serve, there would be no feelings in the first place. As Robert Zients, the psychologist whose work figured centrally in Chapter 11, explained, "Affective judgments are always about the self. They identify the state of the judge in relation to the object of judgment. In the absence of a particular point of view, yours or someone else's, the whole idea of an affective judgment, a feeling, makes no sense. If you truly and completely adopt the vantage point Einstein adopted, if you transcend the perspective of the self, any self, and view things from nowhere in particular, essence disappears, along with the feelings that created it in the first place. When we do this, when we transcend the perspective of self, there's a sense in which we're also transcending the perspective of our whole species. After all, the basic thoughts and feelings that guide us through life, the ones designed to take care of us, are, broadly speaking, characteristic of our species. Though the feeling of homeness that my house exudes may be distinctive at a fine-grained level, in a rougher sense, it's the same feeling lots of people have about their homes. But other species, of course, have their own views of things, and if we're going to thoroughly follow Einstein's example and assume that no single perspective has special access to the truth, then we need to transcend not only the perspective of individual people, but also the perspective of our whole species. We need to drop the assumption that the way we look at things is inherently more valid than the way other animals look at things. So, for example, the fear instilled in a human by a snake amounts to a judgment that the snake is bad, something to be avoided. But the lust inspired by that very same snake in a member of its own species means the snake is good, something to be copulated with. Rotting flesh fills us with revulsion because approaching it could bring contact with tiny parasites. But from the point of view of the tiny parasites, rotting flesh is the ideal culinary milieu. And so on. Stagnant, fetid swamps are off-putting unless you're, say, a mosquito or an alligator, in which case they're sublime. Young pandas like a nice meal of mother panda dung. I think I'll pass, thanks. This relativity of judgment is part of what Buddhists mean when they talk about the illusory nature of everyday perceptions. Chandrakirti, an India Buddhist scholar who lived in the 7th century CE, said that what a human would see as water might seem like nectar to a certain kind of god, and like pus or blood to a hungry ghost, and would taste accordingly. A hungry ghost is a type of being I won't bother to describe, except to say that you definitely don't want to be reincarnated as one. If Chandrakirti had been writing after Darwin, he might have put the point this way. Our entire notion of good and bad, our whole landscape of feelings, fear, lust, love, and the many other feelings, salient and subtle, that inform our everyday thoughts and perceptions, are products of the particular evolutionary history of our species. If having sex with armadillos had been the only way our ancestors could get their genes into the next generation, you and I would think armadillos are attractive, not just cute in an offbeat way, but deeply enticing. You might have trouble controlling your urge to caress them. Alert drivers on country roads in Texas might screech to a halt every now and then for an impromptu armadillo liaison. And needless to say, there would be no moral transgression more grave than killing an innocent armadillo. It's tempting to dismiss such evolutionary hypotheticals as meaningless. Sure, if fruits were toxic to our species and dirt was packed with carbohydrates, then nobody would have a sweet tooth, and the great dieting challenge would be to control your dirt tooth. But so what? We've always known that some things, what tastes good, what qualifies as sexy, are subjective. So the question of what foods and mates are attractive isn't really a question of thinking something is true that isn't really true. Nobody thinks Coke is better than Pepsi in the sense that 4 is greater than 3. Actually, I'm not so sure about that. I've seen people argue about what constitutes great wine or great art, as if convinced they were really right and the other person was wrong. That's the thing about feelings, a thing that is particularly true when we talk about their role in shaping essence. They can render judgment so subtly that we don't realize that it's the feelings that are rendering the judgment. We think the judgment is objective. When I see a Ferrari and feel essence of exotic, pricey sports car, I don't think, but this is just the opinion of one particular member of one particular species, because the perception is too subtle to even register as a full-fledged opinion. More consequentially, when I see in the driver essence of rich show-off, I probably won't discount that judgment either, because, again, I probably won't be reflective enough to realize it's a judgment. It feels more like a simple fact. That's the way the perception of essence works. It smuggles judgments into our mind by cloaking them in feelings that are themselves so subtle, or at least so routine, as to often escape conscious recognition. And these feelings, these elementary ingredients of perceived essence, are by their nature tied to a particular perspective, the perspective of a species, or, as in the Ferrari case, the perspective of an individual within that species. From the perspective that Einstein considered the truest perspective, the point of view from no particular point, feelings don't even exist, and so essence doesn't either. Again, I'm not encouraging you to let go of the entire repertoire of feelings and thoughts that is the heritage of our evolutionary lineage. Your bias toward snake evasion is understandable, if staying alive is high on your list of priorities, as I think it should be. Still, suppose, just a thought experiment, that your goal wasn't living as long as possible, but rather attaining the clearest vision possible. Suppose you wanted to view life on this planet, and reality in general, from some perspective less parochial than the perspective of any one species. Suppose you wanted to view it from some more objective, more transcendent, more universally true perspective. Then you would want to look at a snake without the emotional biases of any species, without the fear and aversion and dislike that comes naturally to a human, and without the lust that comes naturally to a snake's paramour. You'd want to look at a swamp from the standpoint of neither a human nor a mosquito. You'd want to view reality with none of the feelings that evolved in our species or any other species as a way to get genes into the next generation. You'd want, like Einstein, the view from nowhere in particular. The point of view of the universe. The phrase, the view from nowhere, is famously associated with the philosopher Thomas Nagel, who made it the title of a book. The book wasn't about Buddhism. It was about the whole nature of knowing and about the mission of philosophy. And that includes moral philosophy. For example, is there such a thing as an objectivity so complete that you could address moral issues bearing on your own interests without any bias at all? This degree of moral objectivity would be one important, some would say, the most important, consequence of attaining enlightenment. And it may be that, given the nature of the human mind, the only way to fully realize this moral dimension of Buddhist enlightenment would be to realize the other dimensions, the metaphysical ones, to experientially apprehend the truth of, most notably, not self and emptiness. Maybe to get the moral view from nowhere, you need the complete view from nowhere. In any event, the view from nowhere may be the pithiest way of describing what Buddhist enlightenment would be like. The view that carries none of my selfish biases or yours, and that, in a certain sense, isn't even a particularly human perspective or the perspective of any other species. This, truly, would be a view that defied natural selection's authority, because natural selection is all about specific perspectives. It is about creating lots and lots of different perspectives, each of which is shaped fundamentally by the principle that it is truer than competing perspectives, and none of which is naturally imbued with awareness of that fact, much less awareness of its absurdity. Buddhist enlightenment is about transcending all these perspectives. The view from nowhere, the view of impartiality, shouldn't be confused with a view of indifference. The view from nowhere can, and I'd argue should, involve concern for the well-being of all people, and if we're going to be true to Buddhist teaching and to fairly straightforward moral logic, concern for the well-being of all sentient beings. The point is just that the concern would be evenly distributed. No one's welfare is more important than anyone else's. If the view from nowhere sounds like an overly negative way of describing this sort of benevolent transcendence, you could use the phrase coined by the 19th century moral philosopher Henry Sidgwick when he alluded to the self-evident principle that the good of any one individual is of no more importance from the point of view, if I may say so, of the universe than the good of any other. Regardless of your preferred terminology, view from nowhere, point of view of the universe, the upshot is the same. Our ordinary point of view, the one we're naturally endowed with, is seriously misleading. So yes, we can think of natural selection as somewhat like those robot overlords in The Matrix, perpetrating a pervasive and oppressive illusion on behalf of an agenda that we have every right to reject. If looking at things this way helps give you the determination it takes to sustain a serious meditation practice, by all means, look at things this way. At the same time, it is in the spirit of Buddhism to be skeptical of demonizing anyone or anything. So let me say a few kind words about natural selection. It did create sentient life, and sentient life can be a wonderful thing. Indeed, the bliss that is said to be a part of true enlightenment wouldn't be possible without sentience. Neither would the more modest growth of happiness that can be had with more modest progress along the meditative path. You might even say that sentience is what gives life meaning and makes it a matter of moral concern. Certainly, Buddhism's moral emphasis on respect for sentient beings wouldn't make much sense if there weren't any sentient beings around. In that sense, Buddhism and natural selection would seem to be on the same page. Sentient life is a good thing. But if natural selection indeed holds sentient life in high esteem, it's got a funny way of showing it. After all, the creation of complex life has involved the premature death of lots of living things, things judged genetically inferior by natural selection, not to mention tons of violence and suffering. That is why the specialness of self is such a strong intuition. For our ancestors, it was often either them or the other guy, and genes that encouraged them to think the other guy was as important as they were wouldn't have gone anywhere. So the sense of specialness and the attendant baggage of self, whatever you think of them, were unavoidable features of sentient life so long as life was created by natural selection. And be honest, if you had to choose between a planet full of living things that consider themselves special and a planet as barren as Mars, you'd choose the former, right? I would. Yes, barrenness can be beautiful, but if there are no sentient beings, the beauty goes unappreciated and even, in a sense, unrealized. But here's the unfortunate paradox. We've gotten to a point in human history when the sense of specialness could actually endanger the continued flourishing of sentient life. I said in Chapter 2 that I'd spare you the full-length, high-volume version of my sermon about saving the planet, about how the psychology of tribalism threatens to break people apart along religious, national, ethnic, and ideological lines. And I'm a man of my word. Still, it's worth spending a few paragraphs conveying the cosmic context of this prospect, viewing the crossroads we stand at against the backdrop of the whole history of life. A brief history of life. For 4 billion years, life on this planet has been ascending to higher and higher levels of organization. First, there were just bare, self-replicating strands of information. Then they encased themselves in cells. Then some of these cells got together and formed multicellular organisms. Then some of these organisms developed complex brains, and some species of brainy organisms became highly social. One species of social, brainy organism was so social and brainy that it launched a whole second kind of evolution, cultural evolution, the evolution of ideas and customs and technologies. And this second kind of evolution carried the species to higher and higher levels of social organization, from hunter-gatherer village to ancient state to empire and so on, until here we are, on the brink of establishing a cohesive global society. As if to underscore what a natural outgrowth of biological and cultural evolution this is, there is even a kind of emerging global brain, the Internet, animated by the human brains that form its neurons. If you saw all this from outer space and in time lapse, so that billions of years were compressed into minutes, it might seem like you were watching the growth and maturation of a single planetary organism. Indeed, this growth might seem driven by such powerful developmental logic that the continued congealing of that organism, that is, the emergence of a peaceful and orderly global civilization, was inevitable. You'd be wrong about the inevitable part. That's the whole problem. But it's true that the logic behind the process has been powerful. For starters, natural selection is so wildly inventive that the advent of a species smart enough to launch cultural evolution was probably pretty likely all along. The subsequent expansion of our species' social organization, from hunter-gatherer village all the way to globalization, was also likely, because cultural evolution, like biological evolution, has a powerful creative engine behind it. At least, that's the case I made in a book called Non-Zero. I argued that, ever since the Stone Age, the expansion of human social organization has been impelled by a technologically driven growth in the range of interdependence. Over time, people at farther and farther distances from one another have come into contact, and in many cases have come to trade or otherwise cooperate with each other. Today, more than ever, we depend on people halfway around the world for the goods and services that sustain us, as do those people. In other words, the fates of people around the world have become more and more correlated. That's what interdependence is. And oddly, this correlation is actually strengthened by such global problems as climate change, problems that are bad for people in diverse parts of the world, and whose solution would therefore be good for people in diverse parts of the world. In various different senses, people on different continents are in the same boat. It is in our common interest to work together. What could go wrong? Well, if you're viewing the whole thing up close, answers may spring to mind. Here's the answer that springs to my mind. Groups of people fighting with each other. The lines of battle may be ethnic, religious, national, or ideological, but antagonism seems to have grown along many of these lines in recent years. What's more, there seem to be some dangerous positive feedback loops. Antagonism on one side creates more antagonism on the other, which creates more antagonism on the first side, and so on. This is the kind of dynamic that can fuel a long downward spiral, which would be alarming even if we weren't living in an age of nuclear weapons and increasingly lethal and accessible biological weapons. But we are living in such an age. What's more, we're living in an age when information technologies make it easy for relatively small numbers of people bound by a common enmity to find each other, no matter where on earth they are, and then coordinate to deploy violence. Hatred, even when diffuse and far-flung, has increasingly lethal potential. What causes all the hatred? At some level, it's always the same thing. Human beings operating under the influence of human brains whose design presupposed their specialness. That is, human beings operating under the influence of the reality distortion fields that control us in many and subtle ways, convincing us that we and ours are in the right, that we are by nature good, and that when we do the occasional bad thing, it's not a reflection of the real us, whereas they and theirs aren't in the right and aren't by nature good, and when they do the occasional good thing, it's not a reflection of the real them. And it doesn't help matters that these reality distortion fields often magnify, even out-and-out fabricate, the threat posed by them and theirs. So yes, we need to reject the core evolutionary value of the specialness of self. Indeed, there's probably never been a time in human history when this rejection was more vital. But we don't want to reject what is also, in a sense, a value of natural selections, that the creation and sustenance of sentient life is good. Happily, mindfulness meditation is well suited to fighting that first value while serving the second one. As a bonus, it brings us closer to the truth. You could even view mindfulness meditation itself as, in some sense, a part of the natural unfolding of life, part of the ongoing co-evolutionary process. Maybe, given the constraints under which this universe operates, the only way for complex consciousness to arise on this planet was for it to be warped in the process, distorted by the exaltation of self. And maybe, once social organization approaches the global level, the only way for complex consciousness to flourish on this planet, or even to survive, is for it to now be unwarped, or at least partly unwarped. We can thank Buddhism for laying out a path to this unwarping. Buddhism isn't alone in deserving thanks. Thinkers in many religious and philosophical traditions, from ancient times onward, have in some sense seen the problem and have suggested ways of addressing it, which is good, because it means that many traditions have resources to draw on as humankind confronts its collective challenge. But Buddhism deserves credit for so early, so acutely, and so systematically diagnosing the problem, and for offering such a comprehensive prescription. And now, finally, science has corroborated the diagnosis and revealed its roots. The problem was built into us by our creator, natural selection. Fortunately, natural selection also equipped us with the tools for addressing the problem. Rational and reflective faculties that in principle can transcend the circumstances of their birth. And who knows? Maybe they will.